Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine. This is Carol Spindell sitting in for Celeste Quinn. Our guest today is writer Edmund White. He's the author of many books, both novels and nonfiction. His works include This Boy's Life and a biography of Jean Genet. His novel, The Married Man, is set in Paris, and he has been made an officer of the French Order of Arts and Letters. Edmund White lived in Paris for 16 years. The book we are discussing today is actually the second book he's written about his life in Paris. The other is Our Paris, Sketches from Memory, illustrated by the late Hubert Sorin. The book we're talking about today is The Flâneur, A Stroll Through the Paradoxes of Paris. It is the first in a new series from Bloomsbury Press called The Writer and the City. Listeners are welcome to join our conversation. Please call 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Edmund White, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Well, thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here with us today.
I'm glad to be here.
I guess we ought to talk, first of all, about what a flâneur is.
Well, a flâneur is somebody who goes out strolling with no particular purpose in mind. And I guess it's a figure uniquely suited to Paris because Paris has one of the, typically a European city built before the advent of the car, is really a great pedestrian city. And there's so many things to see. And I always felt it was the city where every neighborhood was nice. I know that the Parisians themselves make distinctions between one quartier and another, but I always thought I could live in absolutely any one of them.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, we don't think of flâneurs in London or Rome. We don't even think of flâneurs in Montpellier or Strasbourg. What do you think it is about Paris that encourages this peculiar commitment to just meandering and meandering for hours?
Well, I think it's a city that's wonderfully comfortable for the walker, partly because Paris never is too hot nor too cold. I mean, it almost never snows there. There's a lot of rain, but if you have a good umbrella, you're all set. And so I think there's that. I think there's, it's also, I think the flâneur, at least as it was first imagined in the 19th century, was somebody who had an independent income, a rentier, as the French say, somebody who lives from his investments, and so has nothing to do and just wanders around. Well, there aren't too many of those in smaller towns. They tend to drift to the big cities. I think a city like New York is too busy, too purposeful to really suit itself to flânerie, because New Yorkers are all going somewhere, and even if they're rich, they still feel they should work and make even more money. London, I think, is almost too vast. I mean, Paris is a city that you can walk across from one end to the other in half a day, and you can certainly stay right in the center around the, you know, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th arrondissement, and everything's really within walking distance.
Mm-hmm.
So and then, of course, Paris was entirely rebuilt in the middle of the 19th century in a very, what was then, modern way, with wonderful boulevards that are tree-lined, everything kind of radiating out from these roundabouts, with lots of park furniture, benches, and places to sit, lots of little kiosks, and millions of cafes. I think that's probably the most important thing I've come to last, which is that, you know, a city full of cafes is a great place to stroll and sit, stroll and sit.
Mm-hmm. I think you say at one point that the favorite Parisian occupation is to gawk at people passing by.
Well, that's something somebody said in the 17th century, and it was already true then, and I think the word for a gawker in French is badaud, B-A-D-A-U-D, and there are plenty of them in Paris. People, I mean, they're fairly discreet. They don't stare with their mouths open. But people do like to check each other out, even if it's just to see, to figure out your clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you get them, and how can they reproduce them cheaply?
You quote a lot of writers, both Parisian and other writers who've been drawn to Paris about flânerie. Baudelaire said, "A flâneur is an amateur of life. He weds the crowd and is lost in it." And
I think Baudelaire really had this idea that, I mean, that the flâneur was something like a dandy. That is, he's
out not just to observe, but to be seen himself or herself.
That's right. And he also, and the dandy, I think, is somebody who doesn't who's never seen working. He might actually write something or paint something, but you mustn't be seen struggling. So the idea was really that you should abandon yourself to the crowd with no sketchbook in hand, no notes. I think Americans are uniquely unsuited, probably, to being flaneur. And I mentioned in the book that Margaret Fuller, the great American intellectual, was visiting Paris, I think, in the 1840s and 50s. And she visited. She wrote a letter back to Emerson telling him all the things she'd done. Well, it's absolutely exhausting to hear how much she saw and did. And you think, that is not a flaneur.
Yeah,
a flaneur is not a tourist checking off high points that you must be sure to see. A flaneur is somebody who just abandons herself or himself to the vagaries of street traffic.
Mm-hmm. I thought one of the most eloquent voices in your book about flânerie was the German essayist Walter Benjamin, who, of course, has written about Paris. But he said, Paris becomes a landscape that opens up to the flâneur and a parlor that encloses him. And
yeah,
that
he
paradox.
Has a very good understanding of that distinction that it is both outdoors and in that and full of trees and in that sense a landscape, but that it's also very much like a series of little rooms, and in that way it's like a domestic interior.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like one of the paradoxes of Paris that you point out, since that's your theme, is that it's both a big city, as you give the criteria for in the beginning, but it's also a very intimate city, as you've said.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's a place where people do, I mean, I guess most American cities, there's such a huge turnover of populations. We're such a restless and migrant population. But I think French people probably only make one move in their life from the provinces to Paris. And once they're in Paris, they never leave. And
if they have a good apartment, they can't give it up.
They can't give it up. And it seems to me the social hierarchy there is very clear-cut and sort of the same now as it would have been 100 years ago. And so, especially sort of well-to-do or educated people, anyway, people in a particular caste, whether it's academic or artistic or financial, they all know each other. And it takes them about 5 seconds to figure out the 6 degrees of separation between them and anybody else.
Very different from American intellectual life, in which you can be here, a place like Champaign-Urbana or a place like Madison, Wisconsin, a place like Iowa City, Iowa. You don't have to be in New York.
No. And we're all scattered around, and we don't really know each other that well.
That's right. Very different. I loved this point that doubt and indecisiveness are very key qualities for a flâneur, because it seems like those are qualities that don't do you in very stand you in very good stead in other activities. And
that's right. Well, I mean, I think Walter Benjamin sort of saw it as, well, I think like a lot of European intellectuals, what he was really talking about was himself, but he preferred to talk in a generic, objective way about this person he'd created, the flâneur. And so I think he himself was actually quite torn with doubts about where to eat, what cafe to sit in, what part of Paris to explore. And he was sort of drawn every which way and would come home completely exhausted and starving to death because he'd never been able to figure out which cafe to go to. There were too many temptations.
It's a wonderful description of your line, Paris as a mild hell, so comfortable that it resembles heaven.
Well, I feel that Paris is a melancholy city, and I don't quite know why. It couldn't have been that melancholy in the 19th century. Certainly the second half of the 19th century, it was the capital of the world. But now maybe it's partly because it's a museum city, and so much of its culture is museumified. And partly because it's no longer the leader of the world. But there seems to be something a little bit melancholy about it. But it's a very comfortable one because the French are masters of the art of living, whether it's food, flower arrangements, clothes, anything to do with visual style. They really are superb at, and food and fashion, everything. So they know how to live.
They do, and you point out how Americans often feel that if they could just master this Parisian sureness about how to live, that they would also know how to live. And I think
right.
Most Americans who've been in Paris will recognize that sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
your theme of paradoxes, you then move on to a more serious paradox, which I found very interesting, a discussion of racism in Paris. And you point out that although the French are certainly and can certainly be quite prejudiced, racism has never been institutionalized in France.
Well, that's right. And I think that, you know, you could say, however, that today there is a lot of de facto racism, especially toward North Africans, toward Arabs. I mean, because whereas the rich Arabs tend to go to London, the poor former colonists of France from Morocco or in Algeria and Tunisia go to Paris, and partly because they can all speak French and partly because they have an easier entree there. But once they get there, they oftentimes suffer from the racism that attacks them. I think Black Americans, for instance, find it a fairly congenial place to live. I quote a book by a young American called Tyler Stovall, who was actually born in Paris and who is a Black American and who spent his whole life there. And he interviews lots of Black Americans today, and he asked them, "Is the myth that Paris is this wonderful, welcoming city true or not?" And certainly in the past, there were all these figures like Josephine Baker and Sidney Bechet, the sax player, who had an enormous love for France and felt that they were so accepted there at a time when they would not have been accepted in America when Jim Crow still existed. But in any event, is it true today, is what he asked. And I think with lots of hemming and hawing and qualifying, they still feel that it's a better place to be than any major American city.
Well, there are so many interesting stories in your pages on race and some tiny tragedies. I was very struck by the story of the African-American pilot who volunteered and fought for France in World War I before America entered the war. He had flown many missions by the time America entered World War I in 1917. And when we did, he was transferred to the American Air Force and instantly grounded because he was Black.
Yeah, that's right. Blacks weren't, of course, allowed to be pilots in the American Air Force. They had to be mechanics or laborers of some sort. And, I mean, it was very similar in other ways, too. The Black American soldiers in World War I, after the war, found a tremendous welcome from French women who were fascinated by them. And this angered American military officers who tried to have their Black soldiers confined to camp because they didn't want them fraternizing with white women because then they'd come back to America with the wrong kind of ideas in their heads.
Right. That was very interesting. You talk a lot about the African American literary community who moved to Paris, Baldwin, Wright, Jane. And I thought another very tragic story was the one of Richard Wright, who in the late 1950s, although he had come to France to speak openly about race, to escape racism in America, was afraid to denounce de Gaulle's war in Algeria for fear of being deported.
Well, that's right. I mean, that was a very rough time. I have a friend, I don't mention this in the book, but I have a friend, had a friend, he's died now, who was an Egyptian intellectual who was sort of rich and who had his own magazine in France called The Four Seasons, in which he published articles that were critical of de Gaulle's stance in North Africa. And I think as an Egyptian, he felt very closely concerned. And one day, a friend of his approached him when he was out walking and said, "Don't go home. Don't go home at all because you'll be arrested and put in prison." So he just had the clothes on his back and the money in his wallet, which wasn't much, and he headed for the Italian border and sweet-talked his way across the border and set up shop in Italy, where I met him, you know, 20 years later. But he never went back to France, and he loved Italy because he felt they had been so welcoming to him. But it's true that people were arrested, and the 150 French intellectuals who signed a protest against de Gaulle's policies in Algeria were all imprisoned.
Mm.
I mean, they weren't messing around. And of course in France there's no habeas corpus. And I mean, you know, if you're arrested, you can be arrested and kept in prison for a long time before your case even comes up for a hearing.
Yeah, you point that out, that although writers have spoken up and famously affected several cases and people have been exonerated, that in general, the average person, if a famous writer doesn't take up for you, has quite fewer rights in a French court than in an American court or a British court.
Unless it comes to capital punishment, which we tend to specialize in.
Right, in which the French are horrified by the American tolerance for. Let me just say now, if you'd like to join our conversation today with Edmund White, please feel free, 333-9455, or if you're a long distance, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. One of the other paradoxes that you explore in the book is the French tolerance for homosexuality, and yet the French refusal to face openly the menace of AIDS.
Well, I think that what the French really resist is any kind of special interest group or American-style identity politics. Our society, which really has never had a single dominating group for very long, and since America is made up of nothing but immigrants and a few Native Americans, there's no one powerful group, and so we really developed as a nation full of lobbies, special interest groups, different political voices, and neighborhood leaders, and ethnic leaders. So that's all very familiar to us, but the French don't like that. They believe in universalism, which is an idea that came out of the Enlightenment and the French Revolution, and the basic idea is that everyone should be treated exactly the same, male, female, black or white, gay or straight, and sexuality is considered just a part of your intimate private behavior and not at all an identifying characteristic. So I think that they find, I think that model worked out fine in France, because you have to take a society as a totality. You can't just zero in on one particular feature and say, oh, you see, they're closeted or they're racist or whatever. You have to take the society as a totality, and as a totality, it was a very permissive and progressive place. But when AIDS came along, the problem was that partly because Mitterrand himself had been very good to AIDS, good to gays, and when he was elected in 1981, he had basically dismantled all the laws that had been against homosexuality, and got rid of the special police corps, which was supposed to be arresting gay people, and liberated from prison the few gays who were still there for sexual crimes. That we wouldn't consider crimes anyway. So he had been so progressive and liberal that essentially there was no gay organization existent after 1981 when Mitterrand came to power. And so when AIDS hit France, which was late, around 1985, they had to start from scratch. So on the one side, you had a kind of national political philosophy which was against special interest groups like gays, and on the other hand, you had a complete dismantlement of all gay organizations. So it meant that France was very slow to respond to the AIDS crisis, and somebody much more dictatorial and conservative like Mrs. Thatcher has a much better record, because she immediately went into high gear and had a big scare tactic posters all over England about AIDS, and also gay organizations already existed, and it was easy for them to morph into such organizations as the Terence Higgins Trust, which is the English equivalent to the gay men's health crisis. But so France ended up having four times more cases than England.
Although, when you look at everything else, other than the gay political situation, the situations are quite similar in the two countries.
They were both hit by the disease at the same time. They have more or less the same size population. The gay population is organized more or less the same way, with most gays concentrated in the big cities of Paris or London. So they have every parallel imaginable, and completely different results in terms of how many cases exist. So I think France really, with its kind of very don't ask, don't tell policy, and its refusal to even let journalists mention the at-risk groups in the first 20 paragraphs of a news story, for instance.
That was very telling, the story you tell about Michel Foucault, the famous philosopher, who died of AIDS in 1984. And yet Libération, one of the main newspapers in Paris, denied this on the front page.
Yeah, because they said, you know, they had this totally paranoid and bizarre reaction, as though Michel Foucault's enemies had invented this story in order to denigrate his reputation.
And this is Libération, among the Parisian newspapers, is a paper that we would think of as progressive, as somewhat on the left.
Absolutely.
So I was even more surprised to see that it was that particular paper.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Michel Foucault himself was very slow to understand the nature of AIDS. When I first told him about it in 1981, he laughed and said, "Oh, Edmund, this is too ridiculous, the idea of a disease that is targeted specifically for gays and that you get through sexual transmission. It's some sort of American puritanical phantasmagoria that you've invented, and it can't be true." Mm. And I so unfortunately it was all too true, and he himself died of it. But and he did not want to talk too much about. He didn't want to talk at all about having AIDS before he died, because he had toxoplasmosis, which affects the brain, and he was very worried that that people would think that his last two books, which were in press, were somehow not good because he'd lost his mind. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're as lucid as anything he ever wrote.
It's so sad, isn't it? What a tragedy.
Oh, my God.
It's really a very sad story, a very tragic story.
Yeah.
It's interesting how the Americans and the French have such an opposite idea about equality in this whole thing of identity politics.
And it goes into every area. For instance, take religion. Like, Americans basically feel that parents should be allowed to raise their children in whatever religion they want to. The French have a very different attitude. They feel that the schools should be completely secular, and that the right of secular French society to exist and to resist any particular religion should be sacrosanct, as it were. So, I mean, let me give you a very concrete example. About 10 years ago, some Muslim fathers and mothers decided they didn't want their daughters to participate in gym class at school because their naked bodies might be revealed even to other women in the locker room. And they didn't want their... and they wanted their daughters to cover their hair, not their face. It wasn't a question of a veil. It was a question of a scarf over the head. Well, the French went absolutely ballistic about this, and they said, no, this is religious fanaticism creeping back in. And so they decided to forbid all Arab and Muslim girls from wearing scarves over their heads. And I think they even went so far as to ban the yarmulke for Jewish boys, and the cross for Catholic girls. So, I mean, can you imagine how this would go down in America? I mean, in America, our idea of freedom, I mean, I think basically America was founded by all these weird little religious sects, and so our idea of freedom is religious freedom.
That's right.
Whereas the French Revolution was basically atheistic, or at least rationalistic or deistic. Anyway, it was anti-clerical. And I think that the French, when they became a republic again in 1870, they were dominated by anti-clerical sentiment. People really hated the Catholic Church. And so, I mean, that is two-thirds of the population did. And I think that strain of anti-clericalism, whether it's no matter what religion, remains very, very strong, and it seems like a cornerstone of democracy for the French as opposed to Americans.
Right, although we're the ones who talk about the separation of church and state. And France is officially a Catholic country. They are the country that is really adamantly secular.
It isn't officially a Catholic country. Since 1905, there has been a separation of church and state.
Legally.
It's true that it's predominantly Catholic, but most people don't go to church there. I mean, that is, they go for Easter and Christmas, and that's it.
Right, weddings.
Yeah.
That's right. It's the differences are very interesting, and I think they've led to many misunderstandings. Perhaps one reason French literature is not as well read in this country as it could be, or I don't know what you think about that. But
Well, I think it was very well read. I mean, you know, like the great writers of the 19th century.
Right.
Balzac was certainly every bit as well read as Dickens was. But, you know, I think that and Flaubert is certainly the great father of modernism. But I think in this century, after the generation of Proust, Gide, Genet, after that, I mean, in other words, up until about World War II, everything was still going swimmingly, and you could say the French were dominating every area of the arts, including painting and literature. But after World War II, there's definitely a shift away from France, and I think the French are still licking their wounds about that.
And where would you say the capital of the world shifted? We have a follow-up question here we've received, and that's they'd like to know. I think there's agreement it left Paris, but where did it go?
Well, I think the most interesting cities that I know of are Berlin, London, Tokyo, New York.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, how do I know? I haven't been everywhere. But of the cities I've been to, I would say those are the ones that have the most vital. You feel like in a place like Berlin that people every day are trying to figure out who they are now that they're reunited, now that Berlin is the capital again, now that Germany's trying to take the ascendancy over all of Europe and maybe over all the world again. It certainly is a very thriving, exciting city. And because of the reunification, it's filled with building projects and huge influx of money. And it's turned from a city that was quite isolated from the literally geographically isolated from West Germany before the unification, and where people had to be paid a subsidy in order to convince them to live there. And so only students or very old people on small pensions bothered to live in Berlin. Now it's become the capital of the biggest country in Western Europe, and certainly the richest and most powerful. I mean, I think London is a great, wonderful, fun place to be, and New York and Tokyo, of course, is the center of the whole new Asia.
Well, I have to ask you this question, since you write so lovingly of Paris, and of all these cities that you've mentioned, only Paris encourages Flânerie, and only Paris creates this commitment to Flânerie. After 16 years, why did you decide to leave Paris and come back to your...
I moved back because of my boyfriend. I met an American guy there 6 years ago, and he had lived in he'd worked in the Peace Corps in Yemen and then in Czechoslovakia, and then when I met him he moved to Paris and we lived there 3 years, but he never really took to it. And I mean, he's 25 years younger than I am, and I do think Paris is sort of a city of middle-aged pleasures. I don't think it's too much fun for young people because it's too expensive. There's not really a club scene, there's not really a young people's scene or youth culture the way there is in Berlin or New York or London, say. So I think that it was slightly dull for him, and he never really mastered the language. So he was aching to come back, and I think I felt I had to choose either him or Paris, so I chose him.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, New York's not a bad bet. I mean,
yeah.
I lived in New York for 20 years before I moved to Paris for 16 years, and now I'm back in New York and teaching at Princeton, and I'm very happy with my life.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. We have a caller, Edmund, on line one in Urbana, so they'd like to join. Let's go to the caller on line one now.
Yeah, I haven't been to France, but I'm getting more and more warmed up to the idea of that there. That must be a really great place, because I listened to Channel 2 on Skola. I don't know if you know what that is, but it's...
Yeah, you can hear the news and from various countries around the world.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's got a subtitle there, and you can listen to a half hour of news from France, from Paris, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so, too.
And some of the topics they bring up, some of the things that go on there are just, you know, would never be seen here, and there's so much more, I don't know, they would definitely be viewed a lot more socialistic than here.
Yeah, I think that's right. You could go a whole year watching American television without ever even hearing the word socialism mentioned.
Right.
And it's certainly very rare to hear ideas discussed in America, except for a very few programs on television on Sunday morning or whatever. But I mean, there aren't that many. And I think what's great about France is that people really do debate ideas. I don't know if you've heard about these philosophy cafes, but there are quite a few cafes where people gather around a well-known philosopher who will introduce a topic, usually a question of moral philosophy or ethics, and they'll all sit around the whole Sunday afternoon debating it, you know. And they absolutely love that. They can't get enough of it. It's like ideas are still very much in the air, and you feel that whereas Americans have been kind of anesthetized, I can never say that word, anesthetized to sort of forget that there really are burning issues in the world and not everybody's in agreement with one another. In Europe, and especially in France, there's still a very lively debate about politics, about morality, about all these issues that are still going on.
Yeah, and I guess I had two questions. One mm-hmm. was having to do I might just make one out of it. One of the things that I think has been really great is that in this whole European Union thing, all the squabbles that they have been going on, France has kind of held firm against the kind of market reforms that would kind of destroy a lot of the social welfare kind of stuff that happens in France. And I think that's really great that they've held out. And I was just wondering how you saw that being there, you know, it's the right place. You know,
right. Well, I mean, after all, the Prime Minister Jospin is a socialist, and the socialists do control the government. And I think that Mitterrand had a very long run for his money as the socialist president. Then, he was replaced by Chirac, and the conservatives sort of made a mess of things the way our conservative government is making a mess of things right now in America. So I think just as we'll be happy to get the Democrats back in power, they were very happy to get the socialists back in power, and the economy instantly improved. So even from the point of view of economic selfish interests, the socialists seemed to be able to manage the economy better, partly because labor is very well organized in France, and the socialists have a kind of direct access to the leaders of labor. And I think probably the strongest force supporting the socialist government in France are government functionaries, of which there are many, and teachers. There's a huge army of teachers in France, and almost all of them are socialists. So I think what I'm saying is the power base is very strong. The people are very much in favor of socialist measures, and the government definitely knows how to play ball with other kinds of governments, but it has been very careful in preserving the gains that labor have made, like the 30-hour week, the 35-hour week.
Yeah, well, maybe I will ask one other question, and that is I'll just give you an opportunity to respond to something I saw on TV this weekend. There were four conservatives sitting around a table. One was Lynn Cheney. Another one was Robert Bork. Mm-hmm. They were discussing a book called Making Patriots. Mm-hmm. And somebody asked the author, I don't remember his name, about patriotism in other countries. And they took the opportunity, these conservatives took the opportunity to disparage France because they said that, a good example where patriotism is not very strong is in France, as evidenced by World War II. They really couldn't raise any kind of real patriotic fervor. And then Robert Bork chimed in and said that one reason that they're so unpatriotic is because the French rely on us bailing them out.
I think that's disgusting. You know?
Yeah.
I must say, I think all of that's pretty. First of all, I think Americans love to go in for French bashing. And what's interesting is that it's precisely the Americans who don't know much about France, who don't speak the language, never have been there, or have never read a book about it, who've made up their minds in advance that the French are terrible people. And you oftentimes hear Americans say, oh, France is a beautiful country, but the French are terrible. If only it weren't for the French, and so on. Whereas, in fact, my experience was entirely different, that I think that the French are the most wonderful friends I've ever met, incredibly loyal and so on. But anyway, and very charming, beautifully mannered, well-dressed, attractive people, and very enterprising. But the thing that the idea that the French aren't patriotic because they succumbed to Germany, what about Poland, Czechoslovakia, Austria? All those countries were overrun by Hitler's military might, and the French thought they were well prepared, but in fact they weren't. Are we to say that the Czechs aren't patriotic, the Poles aren't patriotic, the Austrians aren't? I mean, it's absurd. And if Germany had happened to conquer England, would we say they weren't patriotic? I mean, it's true that once France was conquered by the Germans, that then a terrible period set in where I think so many French people felt that the Germans were there to stay, and so they felt they had to accommodate them. And when the war finally came to an end, there was terrible rancor between the rather small percentage of people who had been resistance to the Germans and the larger number of people who had been at least passively collaborationist with the Vichy government. But, how many of us could say that how sure are we that if our country were taken over by an enemy power and who looked like they were going to stay there forever, would we say, oh, well, I don't want to work, I don't want to earn a living, I don't want to collaborate, I don't want to have anything to do with them, I will go into exile somewhere? No, we probably would have played ball too, I'm afraid. That's human nature.
Yeah, and I'll leave off with this, that I am aware that pretty often when people in Europe take polls amongst all the different countries, France is usually tops the list of countries that people admire, not Britain, where there's a lot of social division and such.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, I'd like to thank the caller.
Uh-huh, yeah. Very good questions.
I noticed, though, that in your book you do have a bit of a prescription for Paris, Edmund. As much as you like the old values that you've mentioned that are the grace of living, the art of living in Paris, you feel that it needs to look at the international hybridized culture that exists within its own city limits, the Arab culture, the Turkish culture. And I get the sense that you feel maybe Paris hasn't valued that culture.
Well, I think the official guardians of French high culture don't usually take too much interest in the ethnic culture that exists within the city limits. And I think I was first sort of sensitized to this idea by Juan Goytisolo, who's a great Spanish writer who's lived since the early 60s in Paris, and who is an intense admirer of Muslim culture and did an 11-part TV series for Spanish television on the entire Muslim world, including Turkey, and all of their artistic projects and so on. Well, he's somebody who realized one day that most of the graffiti on the wall in his neighborhood, he lives in the garment district, the Santier, that were written in either Turkish or Arabic. And he thought, wait a minute, I'm out of touch with the people, with my neighbors. So he went to school and learned both Arabic and Turkish, and now has an access to a cultural life in Paris that is certainly maybe the most vital one that's going on there. And I know, like I mentioned in the book, that when I had dinner with Jean-Jacques Ayagon, who's the director of the Centre Georges Pompidou, and Pierre Soulages, who's the leading abstract painter, and so on. There were all these important people around this dinner table, and they said, Paris has really changed. And I said, yes, it's not white anymore. And they all looked totally shocked. I mean, as though they hadn't noticed that really most Parisians now are black or tan or yellow or anyway, there's a huge Vietnamese population, a huge North African population, a huge black African population, and a large population from the Caribbean. So, they just haven't been aware that their city has become a multicultural capital.
Yes, and as much as they decry those horrific Anglo-Saxons and their multiculturalism and their identity politics, maybe this is going to be the real test for Paris. Can they embrace these cultures and accept the vitality they bring to this old city?
I know. I got a letter the other day from Alice Kaplan, who's a French specialist, who wrote a wonderful book called The Collaborator that won I think it was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award this year. Anyway, she was in Paris, and she had a big argument with a French academic who said multiculturalism is the same as ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. And she said, wait a minute, how many tenured professors do you know in France who are black? And, of course, there's not one. And how often do you ever watch French television and see a black person, or even a woman? I mean, it's so rare to in discussion programs to even see women participating. So I think that they've got a long way to go. And though they make fun of our political correctness, I do think that political correctness corrected a lot of the really serious imbalances in our society. Now, having said that, let me just say one other thing real quickly, and that is that the French have passed a marvelous law in terms of sexism called parity, P-A-R-I-T-Y, parité. And what it is that in France, political campaigns are entirely subsidized by the government and not by private donors. But the government has now passed a law saying that if each political party does not have 50-50, at least 50% candidates who are female, that party will be docked an appropriate amount of subsidy. So, in other words, there's a law now enforcing 50-50 parity between men and women candidates in each political party. Well, that's an extraordinarily, I think, progressive and interesting development, and there's nothing like that in America.
No, and we really may change. You'll have to write another book in 16 years and see how that's changed the face of French politics.
Absolutely.
Well, Edmund White, we're going to have to bring this conversation to a close. It's been a pleasure to have you as a guest on the Afternoon Magazine, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'd like to remind readers of the book we're discussing. This is The Flâneur, A Stroll Through the Paradoxes of Paris. It's put out by Bloomsbury Press. It's a lovely little tiny book that you could easily put in your suitcase with you if you're heading for Paris this summer. And if you're not heading for Paris, you could pretend that you are and you could read it anyway. This has been Carol Spindell. I've been sitting in today for Celeste Quinn. Thank you.